Lecture 40, Dynasty 27, The Persians.
Welcome back. Remember last time we left our story with the king of Egypt, Psamtek, captured in Susa by the Persians? I want to talk today about the Persian domination of Egypt. But we're going to have a little fun today. I want to present Herodotus' version, or a Greek tourist who went to Egypt. I want to present his version of how Egypt got into this fix, right? How did Psamtek get captured, and why are the Persians coming into Egypt? Now, we have to go back to the time just before Psamtek is captured. If you'll remember, the previous king is Amasis, the general who took over. And that's when really the Persians start coming in. Well, Herodotus gives us three versions of why the Persians came in. Three versions. And before I give you the versions, let me just tell you that many scholars don't trust Herodotus. Right? Now, there are good reasons. He tells some fantastic tales, real tall tales. I have one colleague who even went so far as to suggest that Herodotus never was in Egypt. Never went there. Just made it up. I don't think that's right. And I don't think really they're being fair to my man Herodotus. I think that Herodotus basically should be viewed as a reporter. He reports what he sees and is told, and I think he tells it honestly. He may have been told a lot of nonsense sometimes. He reports it. But I don't think he's as bad as people think. I'll give you one example of why some people say Herodotus wasn't even in Egypt. When Herodotus visited the pyramids, right, which even in his day was a great tourist site. Now remember, he speaks Greek, not Egyptian, doesn't know the language. He's got a guide taking him around, probably. And he asked his guide at one point, you know, what about the inscriptions on the pyramids? And if you remember, the guide told him that those are the onions and bread and beer. It lists the onions, bread, and beer that the workmen were given for building the pyramid. Now, obviously, no pharaoh was going to put bread and beer and onion, you know, statistics on his pyramid. I think probably the guide couldn't read hieroglyphs and made something up. But Herodotus reports what the guide told him, not that it's the truth. But the real thing that bothers some people about Herodotus' account of his visit to the pyramids is that he never mentions the Sphinx. Never. Now, some people say, well, look, if he visited Giza, where the pyramids are, he would have mentioned the Sphinx. It's pretty impressive. Not necessarily. Remember, the Sphinx was periodically covered over with sand. So it could have been entirely covered even in Herodotus' days. That's certainly possible. Or even, you know, not every tourist, say, to New York mentions the Statue of Liberty. It could have been just something that just didn't get into the diary. So I don't think it's fair to say he never visited Egypt. But let's look at what he says about why the Persians invaded Egypt, right? There's three versions. You can take your pick. Now, the first version involves an eye doctor, right? An eye doctor. It starts in the era of Amasis, when the Persians first entered. And what he says is, the Egyptians were really afraid of the Persians, rightly so. They were fierce people, warriors. And Amasis was asked by the Persians for an eye doctor. The Persians, obviously the king had an eye problem. Cambyses II would have an eye problem. Send me an eye doctor, because the Egyptians are the most skilled in medicine. And the eye doctor is sent. Now, the doctor is really ticked off at Amasis, the pharaoh of Egypt, because he doesn't want to go to the Persians. He doesn't want to leave Egypt. But he's sent out of Egypt. Right? So, he goes to the Persian palace, and he wants to get even with the pharaoh. Right? So he says to Cambyses, he says, you know, Amasis has a beautiful daughter. Why don't you ask for his daughter as a mistress? It's getting even with the pharaoh. And according to Herodotus, Cambyses does it. You know, pretty girl, why not? Sends to Amasis and says, send me your daughter as a mistress. Now, Amasis is in a bind. You know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. What does he do? He sends another girl. Right? Actually, he sends his predecessor, Apries' daughter. The young girl is dressed up in beautiful garments, gold, everything, goes to Persia. Cambyses is happy. Right? He's happy. And then he addresses the girl, he says, you know, talking about her father, right? He says, he's not my father, he's really fooling you, right? I'm really, Aper is the daughter, Amos has sent me to just to fool you. And according to this version, Cambyses gets really ticked off at having been fooled, the wrong girl is sent, and he invades Egypt, okay? Version number one. Maybe you like it, maybe you don't, but we got two more. Next version. In this version, a beautiful Egyptian girl is indeed sent to the Persian king, but it's not to Cambyses II, no. It's to his father, Cyrus. Right, Cyrus the Great? And Cyrus really likes this Egyptian girl. Now, at this time, remember, Cambyses would have been just a little kid, maybe 10 years old. And the kid sees that his mother is very unhappy. And he says, Mother, why are you so unhappy? And the mother explains, well, your father has this new beautiful Egyptian girl, and he's ignoring me. Now, little Cambyses II says, Mother, when I grow up, I will show those Egyptians. I will turn Egypt upside down. And then when he grows up, he remembers that his mother was slighted because an Egyptian girl was sent and invades Egypt. So that's version number two of why the Persians invade Egypt. But Herodotus has a third one, far more detailed and in many ways more believable and more interesting. According to this version, there was a Greek mercenary in the Egyptian army. His name is Phanes. Now, Phanes, for some reason, Herodotus doesn't give us the reason, feels that he has not been treated properly by the Egyptian army. And he goes to Cambyses and says, I know Egypt inside out. I know the roots. I know the military. I can lead an invasion. So Phanes defects to the Persian army, right, because he's dissatisfied. Cambyses thinks it's a good idea. He doesn't know how exactly to invade Egypt, but Phanes knows all the details. And he tells him about, you're going to come across a desert in Syria. When you reach Syria, you're going to hit the desert. And it's not easy to get through the desert without water. I can tell you how to do it. There is a king of this desert area, probably what we would call today a local sheikh, a kind of Bedouin king, and he can supply water for you. Now, according to this Herodotus version, there are really two ways that the water could come, right? Now, one way, and it's fascinating, it's the origin of the 5-cent deposit on a bottle. What Herodotus says is that into Egypt came amphora, wine jars, from Phoenicia, from other areas. All these jars come in. But you never see an empty one in Egypt. He says, they got wine? You never see an empty one. What happens to them? He says, well, the deal is this. The mayor of each town is supposed to send all the empties to Memphis in the north. It's like a depot, a collecting area for the empties. And these empty amphora in Memphis are filled with water. And they are sent to this desert depot, and that's how people can cross the desert. You get all these amphora with, right? So it's like a deposit, the 5-cent deposit, they go back out. Now, what Herodotus says, though, is that this was a time of year where there weren't a lot of these jars in the desert, so that's not going to work. So what Phanes explained to him was that this Bedouin king, this sheikh, king of Arabia is actually how it's called, can have camels with water skins waiting. And that's how the Persians are going to be able to enter into Egypt. There's another slight version Herodotus gives us, and it's really the first pipeline in history, literally. He says that what they did was they sewed together camel skins for almost the whole duration of the desert, the whole length of the desert, and this is a pipeline with water bringing it for the Persian army. So you have either the pipeline version or the camels loaded with water version. But either way, Phanes has told Cambyses how you can cross the desert and enter Egypt. Right, so we've got several versions. The latter one is much more interesting. So Cambyses enters, and he is about to sort of square off with the Egyptian army. Now, the Greeks who were in the Egyptian army about to fight Cambyses are really ticked off at Phanes. I mean, they are furious that he has turned against them, And the two armies are facing each other on a battlefield. And the Greek members of the Egyptian army bring Phanes' sons to the battlefield. And on the battlefield, they bring them one at a time and slit their throats. And they collect the blood in bowls. And then they mix the blood with wine and water. And each Greek member of the Egyptian army drinks it. Now, Phanes is watching this happen, right? So the battle takes place. And the Egyptians are routed. The Egyptians lose. And we have the Persians taking over Egypt. This is Herodotus' version of how, three versions of how the Persians first enter. Now, Herodotus actually is fairly kind to the Persians. He doesn't view them as these cruel tyrants. They often get a very bad press, by the way, the Persians, in ancient history, that they come into Egypt, they sack it, they rule it. You know, maybe not so, at least Herodotus says, they're not so bad. I'll tell you why. Cambyses now is in charge, controlling Egypt. From the north. He sends his herald, a kind of ambassador in, on a ship, to work out the terms of the truce, so to speak. How much tribute do you have to send before, you know, before we don't raise your country to the ground? The herald is coming in on a ship, and the Egyptians see him. And they tear the herald piece by piece, you know, into little bits and bring it back to the town. So the Egyptians really are after, you know, the Persians. They're not going to give in. Now, Cambyses is really angry that his herald has been killed. And he comes in and really levels Memphis and the area. So now we've got Cambyses angered, right? Now, the next story that we get from Herodotus, which is, again, a fantastic story, meaning literally unbelievable. But I'm going to suggest what really happened, because I don't think he's such a bad reporter. Herodotus says, now remember, Herodotus was there around 450 BC, about 75 years after these things happened. So there would have even been people who were children, perhaps, during this time. But he's not going to get an accurate report, but it's not the distant past. Herodotus says, they took me to the battlefield where this battle took place, the first battle when Phanes' children's throats were slit. And the two armies were still lying on the ground, separated. Persian army one side, Egyptian army on another side. And he says, what was most curious was that the skulls of the Persians, now these are skeletons on the battleground, the skulls of the Persians were paper thin and could be pierced by a pebble. But the Egyptian skulls were quite thick, quite thick. And this is what he says he saw. He saw, right? This is not a report. He saw it. Now, he goes further. He says, I asked the Egyptians, how come the Persian skulls are thin and the Egyptian skulls are thick? And he got an explanation that is kind of like adaptation. He said, well, you know, the Egyptians, we shave our hair off. You know, the priests were shaven-headed. And he says, the sun beating down causes the skull to thicken. So it's a kind of adaptive thing. The Persians don't do this. He said, they wore skull caps, so that's why their skulls are thin. That's what he was told. Now, the big problem with the story is what really happens. I mean, surely the Egyptians would not allow their dead to lie on a battlefield for 75 years. No way. And surely Persians don't have such thinner skulls, you know, than Egyptians. And further, why would the men be separated on a battlefield? In a battle, it's hand-to-hand combat in ancient times. Why? Why would they be separate? It doesn't make sense. What was Herodotus shown? I think he saw something. My bet is this, that he was shown a cemetery, perhaps of poor people. And there were bodies lying around. Sometimes the sand blows away. Sometimes cemeteries are uncovered. As a matter of fact, if you go to Egypt today, you can see cemeteries like that. Ancient Egyptian cemeteries where you can just walk through and see bones. I think he was taken to the cemetery and said, what is it? And they told him the story of this is the battlefield. And then perhaps some skulls are thinner than others. And he asked why. And his guide makes up a story. Oh, those are the Persians. They're thin. The Egyptians are thick. Something like that. But at least, I think he's telling us what he saw. So bones on the ground. And then he's trying to give you an explanation of what he was told. Right? So it's a fantastic story. I mean, really just incredible. But anyway, we have Cambyses occupying Egypt. And he is ticked off because they have killed his herald. Right? And he's taken control. Now he has the next king under his thumb, Psamtek. Right? And he wants to see, according to Herodotus, he wants to see what kind of stuff Psamtek is made of. What kind of man is he? So he has all the nobles of Egypt brought together in a kind of almost reviewing stand, is the feeling you get when you hear it. And their daughters, including Psamtek's daughter, are dressed in rags and have water jugs and are forced to give water to the army of the Persians and forced to serve the Persians. And as these women, these noble women, are paraded in front of their fathers, they all weep. All the fathers are weeping for their daughters. Except Psamtek. Psamtek doesn't look at it. I mean, just, he puts his head down and he doesn't weep. Cambyses still wants to see, what is Psamtek made of? All the young noble men are then paraded before their fathers. With bridles in their mouths, they are being led to execution. 2,000 of the noble youth of Egypt. Psamtek sees it go by, bows his head, doesn't weep. Everybody else is weeping. Finally, Psamtek notices an old friend of his, an old man, who is reduced to begging. He's begging from the army of Cambyses. He's in rags. And this was a nobleman, a friend. And Psamtek weeps for his old friend. Now, the messenger of Cambyses reports back to Cambyses Psamtek's reactions to all this. Doesn't weep for his daughter. Doesn't weep for his son. But when he sees the old friend, he's reduced to tears. Cambyses asks for the messenger, go back and find out why. And they ask Psamtek, and he says, when I saw my family, my daughter, my son, reduced to this horrible state, it was so bad that I couldn't even shed a tear. But when I saw a friend, I was able to cry. Right? So it wasn't that he didn't lack emotion, it wasn't he didn't care, it was just the depth of feeling that he had. Now, according to the story, Cambyses was moved by this. He thought, this is a man. And he took Psamtek back with him into his palace. Right? With him into his palace. Now, according to Herodotus, Psamtek didn't learn his lesson. Psamtek was living in the palace with the king. Right? Remember, we ended our last lesson with the king of Egypt in Susa, in the palace. And he was living under the king's largesse. He was being fed. But he plotted against the Persians, right? It's sort of like two things you don't do. You know, you don't tug on Superman's cape, and you don't mess with Cambyses, right? Psamtek is killed, right? Psamtek loses, and then Cambyses is angered by everything. I mean, there's another story where Cambyses goes into Egypt, and he's so angered that he finds the body of Amasis, the previous king. Digs it up. Now it's a mummy. It's not right. It's mummified. It's not going to be just an ordinary body. The mummy is dug up, and he has his men beat the mummy with whips, and he's going to destroy the body. But Herodotus says, but you know, the mummy was so tough because it had been mummified that he couldn't do it. So Cambyses burned it. Right? All chance of immortality is lost. So Herodotus always suggests that Cambyses is provoked. He has reason. The herald is killed. Psamtek plots against them. Interesting. I mean, Herodotus is an interesting man. Anyhow, there is a story that comes next that is just wonderful. Cambyses has heard that the Ethiopians have a table of the sun. A table of the sun. It's a legendary thing. It's a table that is placed in an open field, which has all manner of boiled meats. Now, remember, only the wealthy ate meat. This was a luxury. So this is a table that has all manners of boiled meats. And anyone who wants can come and eat from this table. It's sort of like the free buffet, right? And Cambyses wants to know about this. Is it really true that there is such a table? And he sends messengers into Ethiopia to find out if there really is such a table. And he really wants to invade Ethiopia. That's what he really wants. And these messengers are really spies. But he sends them with gifts to the king of Ethiopia. Right? Sends them with a red cloak. Right? A red cloak. Sends them with gold bangles. Bracelets. Sends them with myrrh in a little alabaster casket. Right? And he sends them with wine. Four gifts for the king of Ethiopia. And we are told even that the translators are from Elephantine Island, which is right by Aswan, the southern border, makes sense, towards the south. They reach the king of Ethiopia with these gifts. And the king is not fooled. Right off the bat, he knows Cambyses wants to invade. He knows it. And he says, "This scarlet cloak, how is it made?" And the men explain that it's dipped in dye. He says, "You know what? Then it's a fraud. It's not really red. It's pretending to be what it isn't. And the men who dyed it, they're frauds too." Uninterested. He asks about the myrrh. "What do you use this stuff for? You know, it smells nice." He says, "We use it to perfume our body." He says, "Well, and again, it's a fraud. It's covering up what you really smell like." Rejects it. The gold. Says, he looks at it, he looks at the bracelets and says, "They look like fetters, like something you keep a prisoner in." He says, "We have much stronger than this." Unimpressed. Only the wine does he like. He likes the wine. He tastes it, he says, "This is pretty good stuff." And then he says, "Tell me, how old do you people live to be?" And he says, "Well, an old man will live to be 80. He says, "We live to be 120. He says, "It's a good thing you have this wine. That's probably what keeps you going to living to 80. But these messengers, supposedly, were taken to a well. Now, the well they described, they said, the water was so light that nothing would float in it. And when you washed in it, it was almost as if your body had been oiled. But these Ethiopians that drank from this well lived to be 120. I mean, so this is a kind of early myth of, you know, the fountain of youth. Well, anyway, this Ethiopian king, unimpressed by the gifts, gives them a gift for Cambyses. It's a big bow, a huge bow. Remember, you know, these people were skilled archers. It's a huge bow, and he says, "Here's a bow. Give it to your king and tell him, when your men can string bows this large and use them, then maybe he can invade Ethiopia." They go back to Cambyses. They tell him. Cambyses is infuriated. Right? The nerve of him not accepting the gifts, sending back this bow, and he quickly decides on a military expedition. Military expedition. But he's going to divide his men. He's going to lead, personally, going to lead them south into Ethiopia. It's a kind of spur-of-the-moment thing. Herodotus even says it. Doesn't plan it well. But the other division, he takes 50,000 of his troops, and he says to them, "You're going to go destroy the Ammonians, the worshippers of Amun, Ammonians, right? And you're going to burn down their temple of their oracle." Now, this is at the Siwa Oasis in the Libyan desert. There was a temple to Amun, and there was an oracle there, world famous. And he tells his 50,000 men, "You are marching across the desert to Siwa to destroy that oracle. I will go south to Ethiopia." So he heads south to Ethiopia. Head south. In Ethiopia, right, it is not easy to journey there. And he's not prepared. And his men start to really experience hardships. They eventually start to starve. They are starving. At one point, they want to go back, but Cambyses says, "No, march on." It's only when they are reduced to cannibalism, it is 1 in 10 is going to be killed, to be eaten by the others, that Cambyses relentlesses, we go back. Right? Now, 1 in 10 is an interesting number, by the way. You know the Romans, when they didn't fight bravely, when their commanders felt they didn't fight bravely, 1 in 10 of them was killed. That's where we get the name, the word decimate. You take 1 in 10 and you kill them. That's why we get decimate from that. But Cambyses returns, right? And he returns to Memphis, where he learns that his army of 50,000 disappeared in the desert. And they have never been found to this day. There is an expedition just getting ready right now to search for Cambyses' missing army. 50,000 men disappeared in the desert. Gets back to Memphis, learns this bad news, but also sees the Egyptians are having a festival. The Apis bull is being paraded. And he thinks they're celebrating because the army of 50,000 has been killed. He's enraged. And he asks them, what is this Apis bull? And they say, it's a god, it's a god. Cambyses says, sure, takes his dagger and stabs the Apis bull. Right? And he says, is your bull made of flesh? He says, is your god made of flesh? The Apis dies. Right? The Apis bull dies. So, again, we get this feeling, Herodotus is trying to say that Cambyses was in some ways perhaps provoked. Right? But anyway, Cambyses takes over Egypt. He is succeeded by Darius the First. Now, Darius takes an interest in Egypt. Cambyses is always a kind of absentee. You know, he does bad things, then he goes back home. Go back home. Darius builds temples at the oasis at Karga. Has his name carved in a cartouche. Right? He wants to be a little bit Egyptian. It's interesting. People always revered the Egyptians. You know, they were always a great civilization. And if you could write your name in a cartouche, you were a god. Because remember, in the Middle East, no other country had a god at its head. Right? You may have had a great king, but not a god. So Darius takes over, but there's a revolt. The Egyptians, one thing they're not used to, they will not knuckle under to foreigners. No matter how brutal it is, no matter how difficult it is, they will always revolt. And we get the Egyptians revolting under Darius. Now he is followed by Xerxes, right, who has 20 years of problems in Egypt. For 20 years, there are going to be Egyptian revolts. He puts down one rebellion after another. Doesn't end the problem. Then finally, he has a satrap. Now, a satrap is an equivalent of a governor, right, who is so brutal that the people will take no more, and they simply rise up. Now, the Persians are ruling out of Susa. They never left a large body of troops in Egypt. They had other problems. Remember, they're trying to dominate the entire Middle East. Egypt is just one place. So they never had a large force. And eventually Xerxes is assassinated, and he's taken over by Artaxerxes. And there's a major, major revolt here, led by the son of Psamtek III. Remember the guy taken to the palace? Doesn't know enough to shut up? And is killed. Well, the son of Psamtek, Inaros of Heliopolis, leads a revolt. Now, the Egyptians are defeated. Inaros is killed. He's executed. But this is the beginning of the end. This is the beginning of the end. The Persians have worries on other borders. And the Egyptians now see they're weakening. The Persians don't have a big army. And Inaros had led a real revolt, a real revolt. Now, we have another ruler coming in, a Persian, Darius II. And it's under him that Egypt becomes independent. Independent. There are rebellions. Eventually he will leave. And the last Persian in Egypt to rule is Artaxerxes II. And he doesn't even write his name in a cartouche. He has given up. Persian rule is over. The Egyptians are free again. They're going to have one last hurrah. We're coming very close to the last native ruler of Egypt. And we'll talk about him next time. See you then.